Welcome to Short Course, episode 128, for April 12th, 2024. I'm your host, Ben Barry. It has been a little bit longer than I'd hoped since the last episode, but to be honest, that's actually work has been very busy for me recently, and so I have not been able to catch up on a number of things, including posting match videos and doing pretty much anything for the last few weeks. So we have a lot to cover, and I'll try and get through as much of it as I can. When I recorded the last episode, it was the Tuesday after the March board meeting, and the main story going around that day was the fact that the board had indeed voted not to waive 10.2 to allow live streaming of that meeting. And so I basically said as much as I could, given that 10.2 was not waived in any form during that meeting. And so at the time, I could only talk about the things that had been that were publicly known already without being the one breaking confidentiality. So since then, a few things have happened. One was that, as I talked about on that episode, we did schedule a special meeting. It was technically a special meeting because it wasn't planned more than 10 days in advance. It was a special meeting just to go over the agenda items that were not covered in that original meeting. And talking to Yi Min since then, he also mentioned the fact that part of the reason he had front-loaded the agenda with the non-executive session items was reasonably thinking that that is what people would be tuning in at 7 o'clock to watch the live stream of. And if we ended up spending hours in executive session, they you know, folks might not have been able to stick around and see what parts of the meeting could be live streamed. So part of what was structuring that agenda was also the assumption, based on the past few meetings, that we would be live streaming. Now, as you can see from the minutes, there was one vote to live stream that failed, and there was some discussion amongst the board about this, primarily around the reasons not to live stream. And it was agreed that the concerns around harassment of the members of the meeting during the live stream would be addressed by not live streaming the meeting as it was happening, but taking a recording and posting that after the fact, which, as I've said before on the podcast, I think if we have to choose between a live stream and a recording, the recording, I think, is actually better. The fact of the matter is, right now, there is no official recording, even though there was a live stream. There were live streams of the January and February board meeting. There are no posted official recordings of those. And so folks either have to go find them from people who recorded the streams and posted them to their own personal pages, or just trust word of mouth of the people that were able to watch the live stream. And to me, that actually, that does a disservice. I think if we're going to make this information available, we should also publish official recordings as well, just so that folks, if they want to go back and refer back to something or remind themselves, or if somebody does watch the live stream and they tell their buddy secondhand that something happened, well, that buddy can go check it out for himself. When we don't post the recordings, in my mind, that encourages this kind of hearsay, lack of authoritative sourcing. And I think that is a disservice to the membership. But at the end of the day, the vote to record the meeting and post the recording got 4 yes votes and 2 no votes, the 4 yeses being Area 1, Jim Boone, Area 4, Ken Cobb, Frank Rizzi, Area 7, and myself, Area 6. Yi Min ended up abstaining because he was the last one to vote. And by that point, Area 2, Layton, and Area 8, Russell, had both voted no. And since there were 7 votes in play, and waiving 10.2 requires a 3/4 majority, then the 2 no votes were enough to sink it. And it is generally recognized that where the president's vote would not change the outcome, he's encouraged to abstain and basically remain neutral. That's kind of a Robert's Rules-ism. It's not a rule per se, but it is a convention. And so I understand why, when the outcome of the vote was already decided, and Yi Min has done this a few other times as president, as the last person to vote, he abstained. Now, one thing that will be interesting going forward is, during this meeting, we accepted the recommendation, or the recommendation from the Area 5 Interim Committee was presented and adopted. And so Dan Click was appointed as the Interim Area 5, and he'll be serving out the rest of the term that would normally end at the end of this year. So there was already going to be a regular Area 5 election this year. And because there were less than 2 years left on Rick Steele's term, which again would have ended at the end of this year anyway, the interim serves until the end of that original term. If there are more than 2 years left on the term, such as in the Area 4 situation, then the interim just serves until the special election is concluded. So Ken Cobb, as interim Area 4, will only serve until the winner of the Area 4 special election is known, and then we'll set a start date for that winner. Whereas Dan, as an interim, is appointed through the end of the year. But by having Dan on the board, there will now be 8 votes in play, which means it will now require 3 no votes to stop a 3/4 vote. So hypothetically, at the April meeting, if we go to wave 10.2 and Layton and Russell both vote no again, but everybody else votes yes, it'll still happen. So a 6-2 vote is enough, where a 5-2 vote was not. So a little interesting quirk of the board dynamics shifting as the number of votes on the board changes with appointing more interims and bringing the board closer to full strength. So the first thing that was queued up on the agenda was a relatively minor thing, but I think something that was still worth talking about, which is formalizing a gift policy. And this is something that Jim Boone had as coming in as interim Area 1, he was concerned about, and this was a small way to sort of get his feet wet trying to drive change. And what kicked this off was there's this promotion that USPSA is doing with Howitzer Clothing, which you might have gotten an email about, you might have gotten a push notification on your USPSA app about, which I don't think is an appropriate use of that app or email blasts, but the board was not consulted about that. But as a part of that launch, the board was also offered some of the USPSA Howitzer cross-branded merch. And I declined. I said, I don't want anything from vendors or sponsors. I don't want anything that would cause any conflict of interest, even hypothetically. And that sort of kicked off this discussion about, okay, what do we actually allow? What is the policy? What isn't? Is getting samples for review allowed versus, if you get a couple samples, that's one thing. If you get 100 samples, then maybe they're not actually samples. And that snowballed into saying, okay, well, this is a pretty easy area to define a policy. Let's write one up and let's adopt it. And the gift policy that Jim wrote is well-defined. And while this is not one of the biggest burning fires in the USPSA world, there have been concerns over the years over board members and employees receiving things from industry people and what is allowed, what is appropriate, and this has now set a standard. And so you can go read the whole policy, but the first little bit of it is receiving a gift of cash, tickets, or other property or activity could compromise or be viewed as compromising that person's ability to make objective and fair business decisions on behalf of USPSA. USPSA always wants to avoid the appearance of impropriety where a conflict of interest or bias may arise in accepting gifts from business contacts or clients. Accordingly, employees and officers may not solicit or accept gifts or entertainment from vendors, suppliers, or clients. This prohibition does not apply to occasional business meals, entertainment activities, or common courtesies of insubstantial value that are consistent with generally accepted business practices, provided that nothing is expected in return. So, notably, the policy does not apply to members of the board that are not officers. It applies to employees and officers of USPSA, which basically are the people who would be in a position of making individual decisions. So this swag from Howitzer wouldn't have fallen into this policy anyway. I would have declined it anyway, but it is good that we at least have defined this, that this is where the line is for employees and officers of USPSA, and anybody who breaks that going forward can't say they didn't know. We have now defined it. And so again, it's a minor thing, but I do think it is a step in the right direction of establishing clear policies in corporate governance. And this is the kind of thing. This is one of a few different areas in which I say, like I said on the previous episode, that progress is happening, but slowly. So things like this, where we're not tackling a bylaws rewrite right out of the gate, but we are looking at small areas where either the policy is vague or undefined or out of date and addressing them where we can. So that's one small area of progress. Something else that was confidential until the minutes were posted from this meeting, which you can now go see, is there was, in fact, a meeting, a special meeting convened in March, which, you know, some people had referred to as a secret meeting. The bylaws do not require that special meetings have notice posted to the membership. It only requires that the board be notified that the meeting is happening. But that said, we agreed that in principle, special meetings, when they are being held, should be the membership should be told about them to avoid this kind of, you know, concern about leaks and rumors about special meetings or secret meetings. A special meeting is just a meeting called on short notice. A regular meeting has to have 10 days notice provided and so forth. A special meeting can be called by three directors or the president on 48 hours notice. But anyway, at that March meeting, which Area 1 Jim Boone, myself, and Area 7 Frank Rizzi were the three directors that called it, we had a pretty long discussion about the services of Jim Johnson, USPSA. Well, I don't really know what he wasn't general counsel. Maybe he was. We never could get a straight answer on what his official role was. I thought the fact that he had an official at USPSA.org email address certainly implied that he was pretty ingrained in the organization. I mean, that's the kind of thing you give to contractors and employees, not simply outside vendors, but all that is over with. The board voted and his services are no longer needed. And so that, to me, is another area where progress is happening slowly, but it is happening. My interactions personally with Jim were negative pretty much from the very beginning. And as events continued to develop and there was more sort of traffic on the board email chain and in meetings, folks came to see that as well. And eventually got to the point where a majority of the board was willing to vote and say, we don't need your services anymore. So that is another area that at the time I couldn't talk about, but where change is happening. But to get back to the actual March board meeting, after the gift policy, we did go into a financial discussion. So the bylaws require that the managing director present a draft budget to the board by the end of March, and nothing about actually when a budget has to be finalized or voted on, simply that a draft budget has to be presented by March 31st. I agree with the general sentiment that even having a draft budget 3 months into the year is something the bylaws committee should address. To me, that is not nearly sufficient if we are actually going to operate in a responsible way. So, you know, we should have a budget for the year, and then we should also have monthly budgets. And this is what we've been advocating for over the past few months. But in the meeting, the draft budget was shown via screen share. It was not emailed out to the board until later. And as it was, you know, without being able to look at the numbers directly, we couldn't really make big heads or tails of it. But it was a draft budget was presented to the board before March 31st. So in that sense, the bylaws were satisfied. But in terms of, you know, what I would have liked to see in the analysis that I've since done is go in and compare the budget to the 2023 budget, the 2023 actuals, which we do have those numbers, and then try and do some estimation based on the drop in revenue from the protests that are ongoing, as well as the increase in revenue from the folks that the ones that are renewing at a higher membership rate, which I still think never should have been raised the way that it was. But when you're looking at the numbers, they are what they are. And I will say, we had the accountant Gary that we contract with, and he was super helpful, very knowledgeable, pointed when we had questions, he pointed to either where the answer was or to say, hey, here's what we know, but if we want to have a really concrete answer for that, here's what we need to put together. So being very reasonable and sort of saying what we did know and then what we didn't know, and kind of trying to say, here are some projections I've put together, but obviously they're based on certain assumptions. Here are the assumptions. You can decide whether they're reasonable or not. So I definitely appreciated everything that he's been doing and bringing, and that definitely has helped to give us a more well-rounded financial picture. But that process is still ongoing. After we basically got to a point where nobody really had any more questions because we just needed time to sit down and look at this draft budget on our own time since it hadn't been sent out ahead of the meeting, we did move on to a brief about the new 24 series classifiers. So this was another situation where they were sent out 3 hours before the meeting started. And I mean, speaking personally for me, I got them at 4 p.m. in my email, but I was working until 5, and then I was doing family stuff until 6:30 when I sat down to start preparing for the board meeting, and I took a quick look at them, but I was not in a position to be prepared to really discuss them. As it was, it wasn't really a discussion anyway. It was sort of a, hey, here's what we're doing. I mean, there wasn't even a vote of the board. It was just, hey, here's what's happening. Any questions? And I will say the good thing about this, so it's 9 new classifiers, and the 24 series are being run very similar to how the 22 series were run, where they're being put out, the diagrams are all posted, and everybody is encouraged to run the new classifiers without marking them in practice score in a particular way so the data can be pulled, but not file them as classifiers. So the end result is, as a club, if you run one of these new, one of these 9 24 series classifiers, you pay $1.50 a shooter instead of $3 a shooter, which $3 a shooter is the rate if you have one classifier in the match. Or if you run one regular, one, you know, accepted classifier and one of these provisional ones, then you would pay 3, but you'd get 2 classifiers. And the idea is any of the 9 that are accepted and that have high hit factors set, once those high hit factors are set, then everybody who shot one of those during this provisional period of April and May will retroactively get that classifier set on their record. So it's, if the ones that you shoot do end up getting adopted, then you basically get a free classifier, just a little bit delayed. And I mean, I think this is a good process. This is what I was advocating for the 23 series that were just released and made official in the January board meeting, when we were again sort of being told that this was happening without really, you know, getting consulted about it. I brought up this question of why don't we put these two 23 series classifiers out there for both feedback in terms of how do they get set up at ranges and to gather more data. And the answer was basically, we have data from nationals and that's all we need. And from what I'm seeing, the 23 series, there's two of them. And it seems like, generally speaking, the high hit factors in most divisions are pretty low. Like, there are guys who are making significant mistakes, racking up 5 Charlies or something and still getting M or GM scores on them. So in my opinion, I think we missed the mark with the 23 series high hit factors. I think taking this approach with the 24 series is a step in the right direction. So I'm glad they're doing it. And also, as I mentioned, the aspect of getting feedback on the stages. So it's been pointed out that one of the two 23 series classifiers, not the fixed time one, but the THS short course one, where you start in the middle and you sort of have to go all the way to the left, all the way to the right, and there's 4 targets to shoot in the middle. There's a 4-foot wall in the middle, and there are 2 things about that 4-foot wall. One is, in the original stage design, it somewhat obscured targets, but because, I guess, what I have heard, this is not official, but what I have heard is there were concerns about walls getting shot and either tearing up the props or making scoring difficult. The targets were rearranged so that the wall no longer obscures the targets, but now it's not actually, it doesn't do anything in the stage from what I've seen. And apparently it's a thing that not all clubs have 4-foot walls. Things are pretty much standardized on 8-foot walls, just because that's a common dimension of 2x4 and 2x2 lumber and all that. But not every club goes to the length of basically taking, you know, and building 2 4-foot walls instead of 1 8-foot wall. So that's an interesting example where the 23 series, again, might have benefited from this kind of feedback period of can we build this with, is there a way to build this with all 8-foot walls instead of 4-footers? Is there a way to either make this wall in the middle meaningful and or just remove it? But that the ship has sailed on that one for 23, but I'm glad that this approach is being taken with the 24 series. After that, as I mentioned, we went through the process of approving the recommendation from the Area 5 interim committee, of which I was a member. We had a few names submitted, but of them, Dan Click definitely seemed to be the one with sort of the most board professional experience and most qualified. And so that was the name we put forward, and the board voted to approve. So far, I've only had a little limited interaction with him, but he seems like a pretty no-nonsense, straight-talking kind of guy. So I appreciate that. And, you know, obviously having another perspective on the board is a good thing. So after that, we went to committee appointments. So this one ended up being a little surprisingly contentious. So Frank and I, so Frank is the chair of the bylaws committee. I am the vice chair. Frank had put out a call for applications. Basically, anybody interested in serving on the discipline committee should send resume, cover letter, whatever information they think we would find interesting and helpful in making the decision. And out of that, we picked three names. And one of them was, as I discussed on the last podcast, Virginia Jo Dunlap. And the discussion basically came down to the fact that she was involved with an effort, 6-8 months ago, something like that, to put together a GoFundMe to basically fund a shareholder member lawsuit against the board, which is not unheard of in Delaware corporate law. In fact, it's not unheard of for some of these lawsuits to be either filed by or joined by directors, you know, one or two directors on the board who think the majority of the board are acting in bad faith or against the bylaws or in some ways violating the best interest of the corporation. And so it's not unheard of for members, shareholders, and directors to all be involved in something like this. But the idea was that, you know, by wanting to be involved with this or being willing to be involved with this lawsuit, she was somehow trying to burn USPSA down, which is not true from what I've seen. Again, I don't know, I don't have an extensive history, but from what we saw from my interactions with her, I found her to be clear-headed, have good suggestions on things generally. But because there was this association that, oh, being willing to be involved in the lawsuit, it was, you know, somehow trying to burn the organization down, when to me, it's just an alternate way of trying to affect change. Yes, you can run for office as I have and try and affect change from the inside, but if you're not electable, or if you're not in a region in an area that is having a director election anytime soon, then to me, a shareholder, a member lawsuit is an equally valid way of trying to get a redress of grievances. So to me, that was not a disqualifying action, but to the rest of the board, it was. So her appointment failed, but I have not had a chance to listen to it, but I actually just saw today, Friday, April 12th, 2024, that Dave Riddle from the Casual Shooters podcast just did an interview with her. So go give that a listen and see what you think about what she has to say. Like I said, I haven't listened to it, but I'm based on my interactions with her, I think it'll be informative and worth your time. But that ship has sailed for now. After that, we moved on to the two names that I put forward to help fill out the discipline committee. They were approved really without any significant discussion. And I should say the two guys that have agreed to be on the committee, they were not involved with anything at this meeting or at the March meeting. So at the subsequent meeting when I presented the discipline committee report and all that, they were not involved with any of that. I was purely handling that because the committee was not yet formed, but there was a sense of urgency to deal with some of these issues. So that was all on me. Since they have been appointed, I honestly, like I said, I've been slammed with work and personal stuff. And so we actually have not had a chance to really make any progress on the various items that have been referred to the committee, but the plan is to start catching up on those and at least address them, right? Not necessarily, I'm not looking to ban anyone. I'm not looking to go scalp hunting, but there needs to be a process that when there are legitimate concerns, there is a place to refer them, conduct an investigation, and hopefully the investigation says, hey, there's nothing here. But if there is something, then gather that evidence, present it to the board, and let the board decide where to go from it. But that is that's the goal, that's the future, that's where we're going. And basically at that point, everything else ended up, it was pretty clear that we were not going to get through the executive session topics. It was already pretty late. Everybody was pretty worn out, and going into the contentious executive session topics late at night, when, I mean, there was no way we were going to get through all of them, was deemed not wise. It was quarter to midnight at that point anyway, and we ended up having a little bit of further discussion about logistics and how to actually resolve things going forward. But yeah, we basically agreed we're just going to have to convene a special meeting to come back to these topics. And so that's what we did the following Monday. The minutes for that meeting are pretty sparse because pretty much everything was done in executive session, starting with a marathon 4-hour one related to a number of member discipline topics, not all of which were the purview of the discipline committee, and not all of which were original to this board. So there were some issues from previous boards that were left unresolved. So if you look at the meeting and then you see what came out this week on social media, the idea that we spent 4 hours talking about just the end result being inviting Mark Stamper to appear before the board meeting, there was more that went on. And as I think is appropriate, because until a determination of some, you know, some action, hey, the board believes that so-and-so did such and such and is receiving thus and such penalty for it, until we get to that point talking about names and who may or may not have done what, it's just prudent to keep those things confidential until there's actually something to take action on. And in this case, and let me also say, you know, what the board records is that the recommendations were accepted unanimously. And basically what that just means is in executive session, there was discussion about, okay, we're going to do X, Y, and Z as a result of these. Here's the next steps for whatever the various topics are. And then the vote that is taken is to act on those various things. And as you may have seen in some of the live streams, the way these non-roll call votes go is it's just all in favor say aye. That's why everybody says aye, all in favor. And so when it ends up being unanimous, it's not like everybody's yes, no, yes, no. It's just, all right, everybody on the same page with what we discussed. And in this case, what was voted on relative to Mark Stamper, which is not what I had recommended, was to invite him to appear at the next board meeting and basically give his side of things, you know, have a chance to speak for himself before any further action was taken. And I mean, just personally, I thought that was not a big deal. I figured, okay, it's not action either way. It's not actually taking any permanent sanction or punishment. It's not enacting anything. So when, you know, this came around at 10:30 at night or whenever, I just thought to myself, okay, yeah, if that's what they want to do, then let's just do that. But admitting when I saw things in the wrong way, I would say if we had that discussion again now, I would say, is this actually worth delaying? Do we actually expect to, given the evidence that we're looking at, do we actually expect to have some kind of revelation about what justified particular actions, or do we just need to move forward with what's in front of us? Because asking someone to appear before the board definitely has this sort of inquisitorial summons heir to it. And in this particular case, it was all over actions that there were digital records of. It wasn't one of these where two folks on the range, it was a he said, she said, everybody had their sort of eyewitness version of things. There were written digital records of what was done. And so let's just, you know, we should, in my mind, we should have looked at that, not done anything. I don't think USPSA should be in the business of policing speech of the members, because that's such an incredible slippery slope of, you know, how many places do we have to check? What's the standard? I just, USPSA should not be in that business, in my opinion. And I think the board should not be responsible for these kinds of things, but we will see what comes of it going forward with the board. The next item of business was the compensation committee report, which not really much to say about that at this point, just because everything is ongoing. But if you, the charter of the compensation committee is posted on the board of director minutes page, I think under the March meeting, but yeah, or maybe February. But if you give that a read, might give you a sense of kind of what's ongoing there, but nothing really to report just yet. And then the final thing was this Delaware memorandum of law from the Delaware law firm that we did get back. And as you can see in the minutes, the vote, the outcome was to form a subcommittee of Yimin, Russell, and Frank to basically put together questions for the law firm about their opinion and sort of try and clarify things. And I mean, we've been at this for, I mean, this is now almost 4 months since Scott was removed. At this point, I don't know that we're going to really get a straight answer out of the lawyers either way. I think it's personally, this is just speaking for Ben Berry, not any discussion that happened during the meeting, just my thoughts as I sit here today on April 12th. I think we just have to move forward and try and make the best situation that we can out of what we've got within the bylaws. And to me, there's not a provision for just even with a unanimous vote, just violating the bylaws and putting someone in as a director after they've been removed. The best approach that I've seen following the bylaws is to revive the motion that I had made at the January board meeting, or I'd put on the agenda at the January board meeting, which was not voted on, to remove the prohibition from the bylaws that a director or president removed under 7.7 can never again for the rest of their life serve as a member of the board or a president. So basically, if somebody's removed and they run again and the members of their area reelect them, then they have a mandate to represent them and to serve again. And by the same token, if the board chooses, they can appoint someone as an interim to even after they've been removed under 7.7. And so to me, that's the only way to get Scott back on the board. And I think the clear message that I've gotten with every email talking about the protests, there are a number of issues that have been brought up, but Scott being unjustly removed from the board is the top of everyone's list. And I agree. I appreciate that Andy Erickson was willing to put in his name and run. And it may be that he ends up still serving the rest of Scott's term if this bylaw change fails. But to me, being in a position where we can get Scott back on the board, have him actually being able to affect some positive change from within the board would be a step in the right direction. But we can't do it at the price of just ignoring the bylaws either. And one final thing that I do want to address, just because it has sort of been a topic that I haven't had a chance to bring up on the podcast since it happened, is about 2 weeks ago at the end of March 30th, there was a, that weekend, there was a sort of minor social media news cycle around the stages for IPSC Nationals being set up at the club where IPSC Nationals was being hosted. And some of the stages that there were match video of looked really almost picture perfect to the diagrams that were posted in the IPSC matchbook. And the concern from this was, well, are the stages just set up weeks in advance and people are having a chance, locals are having a chance to practice on them? And that was the discussion. That's what it seemed like might have been happening. And I had folks reaching out to me saying, hey, is this like, what's the deal here? What's going on with this? Is the board aware of this? Is the board going to do anything about this? And so I just put up a single Instagram story that just said, hey, I've been seeing what looks like the stages from IPSC Nationals being run at the range. If you have any evidence about this, send it to me. I'd like to look at it. And if there's something to be done, then we'll refer the matter to the discipline committee. And what ended up happening was a bunch of folks sent me the YouTube videos and the Instagram videos that I'd mostly been able to track down just from people posting them elsewhere already. And pretty much what it looks like happened is there were a series of three matches in the three weekends. So that was the second of three. So since then there was a third one at the most recent weekend before the match, which is actually going on right now as I record this, at local clubs. So it was at Rio Salado on March 23rd and March 30th, and at another range this past weekend on April 6th, they were running IPSC matches in part to get the local competitors and local ROs used to IPSC rules, but also as, you know, a little bit of a practice. And at some of the matches, some of the stages were set up either very directly inspired by or almost an exact copy of the stages in the stage book. And it is certainly not a good look. The argument was made that once the matchbook is published, anybody can build these stages, and there's something to that. But I think what people, myself included, were particularly alarmed by was what looked like getting to actually get practice runs on some of the props. In particular, they have a seesaw prop where, because IPSC rules dictate that you can't run outside the shooting area, you have to actually traverse the seesaw during the stage. And the concern was, hey, people are going to get practice runs on this prop, and it'll be the actual thing that's used in the match. And there is some concern to that. I think the flip side of that is, depending on which match it was either 3 weeks, 2 weeks, or a week before the actual match, none of these stages were the actual stages that were set up for the match. They were based on the matchbook. And so, again, it's not good optics, but I don't know that there's actually any action to be taken here. There was definitely discussion online about, well, any stage that was run at a club match should have to be redesigned and, you know, have that actual stage not be run at IPSC Nationals. To me, that's a pretty extreme switch. I mean, good stages, ideally, I mean, so for example, with Area 6, I'm trying to pull stages that are at least based on something that's been run at least a large level 1 or level 2 match, something that has run successfully in the past. Now, it might have run 8, 6, 12 months ago somewhere else, and so it's not like people are getting practice runs on the stage, but there is something to be said for using stages that have been vetted, that have been made sure that there aren't shoot-throughs and the props all line up with what you have available at the range and all of these things. And there is also, I don't know exactly to what degree this was involved with IPSC Nationals, but in general with IPSC matches, just like here in the US, you have to get your stages approved for a major match. I believe IPSC has its own stage approval process. And so going through that would have been non-trivial. First of all, redesigning 7 to 10 stages and then getting them approved, making sure they get built and all based on what looked to me like, so what it looked like was something that is known to happen in some, with some major matches, which is the stages get set up on the actual ranges and locals get a chance to practice on the exact stages. And this, as far as I can tell from everything that was, that was sent to me, that is not what was happening here. The stages were, they were set up, they were shot, they were torn down. It still looks bad, but I don't know that shooting copies, recreations of the stage weeks ahead of the actual match really will end up swinging the results by that much. Now, I could be wrong. Could be Sunday by the time you're listening to this and the outcome of the match comes down to 5 match points and someone who had a chance to shoot a practice match wins it over someone who didn't, and we're arguing over did the practice match swing the outcome. I genuinely hope not. I genuinely hope that this turns out to be a non-event. I'm not going looking for trouble. I was not trying to stir the pot with that post. I just genuinely thought it'd be interesting to put out the call and see what came back. And I certainly got some interesting things back. But at the end of the day, nothing that I personally saw convinced me that this was the result or would have the outcome of significantly skewing the result of the match. Maybe I got fooled. Maybe nobody sent me the really good information, but I sort of had the choice based on what was presented to me of how to go forward. And to me, there looked like no action to take. So I just wanted to follow up on that. I do still think from a accountability perspective, when there are issues like this, USPSA or the leadership or however you want to look at it, somebody in a position of to actually do something about it, having someone actually say, hey, we hear the concerns, we're going to look into it. If there is something to be done about it, we'll follow up on it, rather than just assuming that it's going to get swept under the rug. I still think that's the right thing to do. I still think having the discussion, saying, hey, what's actually going on here? And if I had seen things that looked genuinely like something actually was going on, something untoward was going on, then that would be the point where it escalates and start calling people up, having phone calls and say, okay, what's going on here? Explain to me why this is what it doesn't look like, why it isn't what it looks like and all that. And even that I didn't really see from the videos that were sent to me and the discussions that I had, I didn't see that. And so at the end of the day, again, hopefully this turns out to be a non-issue, just sort of a footnote in the history of USPSA. And the match turns out to be a smashing success and everybody's happy. And it sort of sets a new bar of quality for what IPSC nationals can be in the US, because I do think having at least one really good IPSC match a year is a good thing. I like shooting good IPSC matches. We've kind of struggled with those recently. And I definitely think having something to whet people's appetites and hopefully set the table for more matches like this in the future is a good thing. But we'll see what comes out. We'll see what the match videos of the actual stages end up looking like. And yeah, we'll go from there. But I did just want to follow up on that in the sense that it wasn't forgotten, but from what I saw, there was really nothing to be done about the events that I saw. And that's really all I can go on. So, well, that wraps up this episode of Short Course. If you want to get in touch with me, my email is bennett@berryshooting.com. Talk to you next time.